The Legal Sunday, The Constitutional Aspect of the Question, Chapter 4. Objections to the ground that Sunday laws are passed to the general interests of morality. We now approach the consideration of a class of cases which form a sort of connecting link between the two classes just mentioned, as well as a connecting link between the two subdivisions of those classes, respectively. The cases of this last class sustain Sunday laws as legislation in the interest of morality. This allies them closely with the cases which sustain these laws as legislation in the interests of religion, more closely, as will presently appear, in the minds of the judges who occupy this moral ground than right thinking justifies. It also allies them closely with cases that sustain Sunday laws as legislation in the interest of idleness, because morality is intimately connected with secular behavior. And these cases form a connecting link between the two subdivisions of the classes just considered, because they regard Sunday laws as designed primarily for the benefit of the compulsory idler, and through him for the benefit of the community at large. The idea being that the standard of morality is higher or lower in a community according as compulsory idleness on Sunday is more or less strictly enforced. A fundamental objection to Sunday laws has been found in the essential immorality of their spirit and effect. But the plan of this work demands that we shall not be content with establishing positions of our own, but shall attack and demolish, if it may be, every position occupied by our adversaries. And to this end, it is necessary that a few words should be added here to what has already been said about the moral aspect of Sunday laws. The cases which rest Sunday laws on the moral basis are abundant, but, as heretofore, only a few will be cited. We are told in New York that the law considers violation of the first day of the week as immoral. One Ruggles case and the Pennsylvania Sunday law has been sustained on the ground that the suppression of vice and immorality are state objects. Two Omits case, and in Alabama, the object of the law is to prevent vice and immorality. Three Hooper versus Edwards, 280, and so forth and so on. Now, this word morality is a much abused word. We have, for instance, a very entertaining book by Marmontel called Contes Moraux, which means tales of manners. But this is rendered in the English translation moral tales, an absurd title in connection with some portions of the contents. Morality is derived from mores, and mores does mean manners or customs, and these are just the very matters with which American law is concerned. But morality has come to have with us a double sense, an internal and an external sense. In the first sense, it applies to our conduct in relation to deity. It means obedience to divine law, which American courts can neither ascertain nor enforce. This internal morality is the business of religion, the domain of the church, into which the state has no more right to intrude than has the church the right to meddle with the external morality or manners of the people by use of the state's police. For the sake of clear thinking, we ought to confine the word morals to its internal application. But etymologically, as has been said, it comes within the purview of the state, and it is subject to its police power. The police power deals with the manners of the people and with these alone. But manners or behavior presuppose intercourse with others, and this brings us back to our principle that it is only with the effect of our actions on others that the power has to do. Thus, to take other illustrations, the police power may compel me to be vaccinated, not because I would be more likely to catch the smallpox if unvaccinated, nor because, if I caught it, I would probably die, but because, unvaccinated, I am liable to become a source of contagion to other people. But the police power could not compel me to have a limb amputated because the bone was decayed, nor to wear a truss for rupture, nor to diet myself for dyspepsia, nor to exercise at stated intervals, nor to rest, though any or all of these be most excellent things for me to do. And this brings us to a brief consideration of one of the most singular pleas that has ever been made on behalf of the Sunday laws. It being contended in a New York case that such a law was passed in excess of legislative powers, and that the question of excess vel non was cognizable by the court, the latter abdicated its jurisdiction over the matter in these words: "It is exclusively for the legislature to determine what acts should be prohibited as dangerous to the community. The laws of every civilized state embrace a long list of offenses, mala prohibita, as distinguished from those which are mala in se. If the argument in behalf of the plaintiff in error is sound, I see no way of saving the class of mala prohibita." 1 Lindenmuller's case, 548. Now, the best thinkers have long since abandoned the distinction between mala in se and mala prohibita, which itself belongs to the union of church and state, the mala in se being things which were considered as forbidden by deity, the mala prohibita things which man prohibits out of his own head. That this is the true distinction is plain enough from the language of Blackstone, 2 ID 54 sec, and other writers to date. Thus, if we look into Judge Sharswood's edition of Blackstone, we shall find a long note on the original writer's explanation of the difference between mala prohibita and mala in se, quoted from Judge Christian's edition. Judge Christian tangles himself up in an amusing effort to prove that there is a moral obligation to obey a law against stealing which does not exist in regard to a game law. And Judge Sharswood gravely attacks the morality of this reasoning, while no less gravely asserting that its soundness as a legal principle, though it once had sway in the courts, has been since repudiated. In Judge Sharswood's opinion, there is a moral obligation to obey every law of the community in which one lives. Mr. Justice Blackstone wrote, "In an age in which heresy and nonconformity, etc., were punishable as crimes, and in a country where the established church is one of the foundation stones of the Constitution, it was, therefore, proper enough for him to distinguish in a legal treatise between the mala in se, the immoral things, contrary to the law of deity, which the civil law of his country also punished under its divine right to govern, and the mala prohibita, or things which were not penal under the law of deity, and were punished by the law of his country without any reference to its mission as the upholder of the Almighty's authority and the avenger of his affronted dignity." Perhaps Judge Christian would have been further from his zeitgeist than we have any right to expect a judge to be, had he seen that, along with the established church and such crimes as heresy, the distinction between mala prohibita and mala in se vanished from American law at the Revolution. But Judge Sharswood might surely have been expected to tell us that our law has nothing whatever to do with moral obligations, has no means of defining them, no standard for measuring them, that whether a man's conscience ought to constrain him to obey any or all laws is altogether between the man and his conscience, and therefore any discussion of this purely moral question is utterly out of place in an American law book, as far removed from the proper sphere of such a work as the consideration of the Darwinian hypothesis. That the existence or non-existence of this moral obligation, being a legal principle in no sense whatever, could neither be affirmed nor repudiated by American courts under any conceivable combination of circumstances, it being as completely beyond their cognizance or adjudication as the obligation to go to confession once a year, or give tithes of all we possess to the church, or to make a pilgrimage to Mecca. In one word, that American law has nothing whatever to do with morality or immorality, but deals with civility and incivility alone. These two things are often confounded, but to confound them is to destroy the possibility of clear thinking. The classification of Blackstone, followed by the state codes, helps to the false conception. Sunday laws and the like are distinguished from other laws as being directed against vice and immorality, that being the canting substitute of modern Brownism for Blackstone's frank phrase, offenses against God and religion. And the cases follow the codes, and thus we find this fatal confusion of ideas, this fallacious conception of the true function and domain of American law, rooted strongly in our jurisprudence. But the fact remains that this law of ours does not distinguish, and has no means whereby to distinguish between things as bona and as mala in se. Its sole distinction is, and must forever of necessity remain, between things which are prohibita and things which are non-prohibita. Mala in se, sometimes loosely applied to things prohibited by the common law, as distinguished from things prohibited by statute. But the phrase is wholly unnecessary, and, as it suggests a jurisdiction over morals possessed by no American tribunal, it ought to be discarded altogether. Where the common law has been adopted in any state, whatever is forbidden by that law is prohibitum, just as whatever is forbidden by a state statute is so. That which is forbidden by neither, however, malum in se, is beyond the purview of our courts. The class of mala prohibita, then, while its first name should be dropped, as irrelevant and suggesting a fallacy, is not only to be saved, but it is to be proclaimed the only class of things with which the law has any concern whatever. As already remarked, in adopting the common law, the state constitutions usually add some qualifying expression, for example, as far as applicable, as may be adapted, etc. Where these words occur in a constitution, and it is claimed that something is prohibitum by the common law, besides settling this point, the court must go a step further and decide whether the prohibition is part of the common law as adopted by the Constitution. Where it is claimed that something is prohibitum under a statute, the court must decide the validity of this claim by reference to the statute. And finally, when a citizen is arraigned for the doing of a thing which is prohibitum by statute and alleges in his defense that the passage of the statute is a thing prohibitum to the legislature, the courts must look into the Constitution and fearlessly and without prejudice pronounce according thereto. 14.